This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a real pleasure for me to have in the studio the history professor Richard Immerman of Temple University. Professor Immerman has a new and important book out that I found really fascinating. It's called Empire for Liberty, A History of American Imperialism from Benjamin Franklin to Paul Wolfowitz. Professor Immerman, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Give me a little sense of your background. Where were you born? How'd you get interested in becoming a history professor?
I was born in New York City and raised in suburban New York. In fact, my biography is really sort of the biography of any baby boomer who was born around that time. I went to Cornell as an undergraduate in the late 1960s. This was, of course, the time of the Vietnam War. Among the courses I took was a course in foreign policy taught by Walter Lefebvre. I was myself quite active politically in really anti-war movements at that point.
Were you an SDS or a successor? Or what were you doing?
I was not in SDS. I had, how do I put it? I had some questions about SDS in terms of its, I guess you would say, political sophistication, and was involved actually with an offshoot, a group at that point called the Labor Party, which...
Was this the PLP people?
It was called the Labor Party. It was a leader at that point was a guy by the name of Lynn Marcus, who then morphed into Lyndon LaRouche.
It's a serious morph, too.
It was a serious morph, and it's probably a reason why I've never been involved in any political organization subsequently. But during that time, in between what was going on in Vietnam, courses by Lefebvre, George Kahan, who was an expert in Vietnam, I became, I wouldn't say obsessed, but certainly engaged in exploring the issues that led to American involvement, and that ultimately led me to the road of becoming a historian, or at least going to graduate school.
And that there seems to be a direct line from there to the subject of this book, which is Empire for Liberty.
It certainly was. Although I can't say that at that point I began to conceive of this book, although in retrospect the questions that I addressed were questions that always provoked me. And when I did write the book, I looked back really at this entire experience, including not just Lefebvre's lectures, but questions that arose during that time, which included actually the phrase Empire for Liberty.
And where does that phrase come from?
It comes from Thomas Jefferson. He's writing to James Madison, his protege, in 1809, early 19th century. And what was significant to me is that earlier he had used the phrase Empire of Liberty. He changed it to Empire for Liberty. Perhaps that's not significant. I'm a historian. I argue that it is significant because it suggested a shift to a more proactive promoter of liberty. Later, people would call that exporting American liberty, American democracy, American system. And that really does frame my book in certain ways.
Or an imposer of liberty.
Or an imposer of, right. of liberty. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately where I came. I think from the perspective of many American elites, exporting and imposing were almost the same thing.
But that equation suggests their insensitivity to the people they were imposing it on.
Yes, insensitivity, although there will be some who would argue that they were uplifting those people. There are some, I do this through biography, that, so there were people like William Henry Seward who all but denied that there were people there. It was almost as if it were unpopulated area. And then there were those who would argue that they had to remove target peoples in order to extend that liberty. So insensitivity sort of is in the eye of the beholder, and it certainly wasn't being beheld by those who were formulating the policies.
And even my use of the word insensitivity is a euphemism for racism, which was which you've detected in your biographical sketches of six representative figures of U.S. empire. Those figures being Ben Franklin, John Quincy Adams, Seward, Henry Cabot Lodge, John Dulles, and Wolfowitz. I mean, Seward was talking about the inferior masses.
Correct.
Here in the United States, of Native Americans and blacks.
Correct. And I mean, it was quite interesting in that Seward sort of began and sort of made his political career as, if not a radical abolitionist, certainly someone who was sympathetic and became the Senate spokesperson against slavery. And yet, in terms of expansion, and even before the Civil War, he is sort of defining, I don't want to say defining, but essentially presenting non-whites, non-Caucasians, particularly in this case Native Americans or Hispanics, as impeding the expansion of the United States and therefore the progress of civilization. But going back to Ben Franklin, he's also arguing about Native Americans and others and even immigrant groups who didn't fit the perception. And then we see it is pretty much of a constant. There are those like John Quincy Adams, again, associated with the anti-slavery, but extremely wary of particularly Hispanics or others. And this had to do with really the subtext of the Mexican War and then later the All-Mexico movement.
And also, I mean, his racism toward Latin Americans, as you're depicting in here, Professor Immerman, is in a sense part of the foundation of the Monroe Doctrine, or allows him to propagate the Monroe Doctrine without feeling bad about it.
That's the Monroe Doctrine, but in addition to that, his decision, his opposition to recognizing the independence of Latin American countries, actually from the Caribbean all the way down, as well as his effort. He always assumed that the United States would acquire Cuba sooner rather than later.
You know, it's interesting this because I've talked about empire and a lot and written a lot about it in the pages of the Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio, by the way. But this idea that we're an empire at birth is something that I didn't really grasp. I mean, you have in the first page of your book, Professor Immerman's book, Empire for Liberty, George Washington himself calling this an infant empire or a nascent empire. And this idea that the founders of the country viewed it in imperial terms is quite interesting to me.
Well,
were you surprised by that? How'd you come across that?
I wasn't in that I again, going way back, knew about those quotes. And there's a certain inherent logic. The United States was, of course, sort of born and raised under the British. It was very difficult for the United States to declare its independence, to break from that empire. It believed that empire was a good thing. Part of the reason, a major reason that I chose to focus on Ben Franklin is that no one wrestled with that issue more in a more anguished manner than he did, believed more strongly in the British Empire, lived in London much of his adult life. It was, in his view and that of others, when the British Empire degenerated, when it did not recognize the beneficence of an empire and incorporating the United States, the colonists, as an equal member, that he began to move away and then ultimately reached the conclusion of declaring independence.
So he didn't move away from the idea of an empire. He moved away from the idea that the British were practicing empire in the best way.
No, that is true. Now, what is interesting about that, or I found quite fascinating, is that Americans could use the term empire, such as Washington's using it, Hamilton's using it. It was actually quite common at that point, really for these two reasons. One, that ours was going to be the empire that the British Empire should have been. But secondly, that empire as a term, had a less pejorative connotation at that point. It was in many ways synonymous with a state. How large the state was, I think, really determined whether it was used. But it was a state. It was a political entity.
When did it get a bad odor?
Really, after the Civil War, in a great way. So, for example, if empire was used even during the Mexican War, it would not have been necessarily a negative term. After the Civil War, it gets associated with the word imperialism. Part of that has to do with the new imperialism that is a global phenomenon. And because of that, in the United States, evolve groups associated with both the imperialists and the anti-imperialists. And the anti-imperialists clearly and unequivocally portray empire as something that is against the American tradition. And conventions, this became more so as the American empire expanded to non-contiguous areas.
So, for instance, Hawaii and the Philippines. And you're saying in your book that this was the closest the U.S. came to traditional or classical imperialism with the conquering of Hawaii and the Philippines, correct?
That's correct. I mean, it was virtually indistinguishable.
From what the Germans and the Belgians were doing, right.
What was associated with the Europeans. And that leads to some really fascinating arguments, debates within the United States. There are those like Henry Cabot Lodge who boast about that, who are proud of that, that this type of expansion, this type of imperialism is really a signal, an index of American greatness. And therefore, even though certainly there were downsides to it, including, for example, the war in the Philippines was just a horrific war. He has no compunction about using that term and talking about American conquest.
And he rationalized the brutality that the U.S. engaged in the Philippines, again, with just the most racist rationalizations, the semi-civilized people, he called them. They have an Asiatic indifference to life, which is a real echo of what people were generals were saying in Vietnam.
That's right.
Boy, it was astonishing to see that.
Now, he did, but with and he ultimately, in terms of Lodge, it also translates into an avidly sort of anti-immigration position within the United States. There's a consistency there. But I argue in terms of Lodge that he did talk in very racial terms and used the notion that of indigenous Filipinos standing in the way of progress and the ultimate civilization part. But in his case, I really think those were sort of almost second-order issues, rationalization. To Lodge, it was all about American nationalism and American greatness. And just projecting that was in itself a high enough value that everything else was almost subordinated to that.
And then after these kind of classic examples of U.S. imperialism in the Philippines and in Hawaii, the U.S. took a more veiled role. I mean, it was neo-imperialism for the most part in the 20th century, economic imperialism without putting the army there and just subjugating and slaughtering people. Yeah. And that's been that's been controversial for some people. You know, does it even equate to imperialism or empire? Where do you come down on that?
I do think it's an empire. It dates back to, interestingly, British historians, this notion of imperialism of free trade. Empire, as I define it, and I do try to define it in the book as clearly as I can, as explicitly, is really about sort of power and control. Power control both internally and externally of sort of foreign targets. And I think it quite unequivocal that whether or not the United States actually annexed territory, such as in Hawaii or in the Philippines, or in other areas of Central America, whether it just temporarily occupied the countries, that it certainly is part of an empire. It has to do with control of sovereignty of political decisions. I don't see any other way to explain that. Historians come up with euphemisms, and do that, you know, a hegemonic power, try to distinguish between internal and external control, but in the United States it really did exercise both.
And then with George W. Bush, you say that his attack on Iraq and occupation of Iraq was as close to that late 19th century style of imperialism, actually kind of a throwback versus the neo-imperialism that we were engaging in throughout much of the 20th century.
Yes, in many ways.
Except
it was.
Vietnam and
right.
Korea.
And there again, I find it quite fascinating. It's sort of a thou dost protest too much syndrome that Bush himself was very aggressive and very explicit in denying that America was an empire. He felt necessary to do that. He argued, in fact, that the United States had never been an empire, even though it had power and therefore distinguished America from all other great powers. And yet, there are many in his own administration who use that term empire, and certainly in the journalistic and academic world, one of the things I point out is that whereas empire was rarely used in the title of an article, let alone a book written about American expansion, it became ubiquitous in the 21st century.
But in a weird way, because there were people saying, we're a benign empire. We're the first. We're the only benign empire.
Empire light is the way that it's used, and often is a criticism, because by great historian, Charles Mayer, made this point that America is an empire that dares not use its name. That concept, to some, suggested that the United States would not behave as an empire, and that was that had adverse consequences on the globe, because it allowed for this sort of chaos and fluidity and lack of control that could lead to ethnic cleansing in certain areas, terrorism, you know, everything else.
And this is a neocon view that we should have thrown our weight around more.
That is, and it's not just neocons, although it's also sort of the muscular realists and others like that, but yes, very much so. And there is this argument frequently associated with those, not just neocons, but those who many consider sort of liberal, that felt that it was America had a responsibility to behave this way because otherwise the world would act irresponsibly.
It's almost white man's burden. I'm speaking with Professor Richard Immerman of Temple University. He's the author of a really important book called Empire for Liberty, A History of American Imperialism from Benjamin Franklin to Paul Wolfowitz, one of those neocons. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. What about Wolfowitz? Why'd you focus on him?
Wolfowitz is great. I mean, he was in many ways, I don't want to say sort of the archetypical subject, but he really is a public intellectual, and is as a consequence, he articulated his arguments, his philosophy, his ideology more explicitly than others in many ways. And by tracing his background, you could see where it came from, that Wolfowitz came from a family that had emigrated to the United States before the Holocaust, but in the context of that. He spent his youth – he was a brilliant guy, and he spent his youth obsessed with reading about the Holocaust as well as the bombing of Hiroshima and World War II. And as a result, by time he reached maturation, studying under everyone from Leo Strauss on one hand to Albert Wolfstetter on the other, he had concluded there was evil in the world, that the United States had the capabilities, the power to eradicate that evil, that if it didn't, that evil was going to spread and do serious harm to lots of people. And as a result, he was this sort of Empire for Liberty guy, this guy who was so activist in promoting his view to the extent that he was critical of the Jean Kirkpatricks because they did not privilege human rights to the extent that he felt it was necessary. He was I write that there is this inherent tension between empire and liberty, and I don't think anyone manifested that, suffered from that tension, more than Paul Wolfowitz.
And he also made other people suffer for it. And you say in the book, this empire for liberty tension actually is an oxymoron, almost, in some places, if you look at the victims of U.S. empire, right?
That is basically where I conclude, that whereas Americans were able to use the ambiguity of both empire and liberty to reconcile the two, that inherently they were contradictory, or they were fundamentally opposed to the extent that there was a trajectory that seemed to be heading towards a collision, and I argue that that collision took place in Iraq.
Professor Richard Immerman, if I have one criticism of your book, it would be that by focusing on six individuals, you underplay the economic forces that drive or participate in the formation of U.S. imperial policy. I'm sure I'm not the only person who has raised this for you, so I'm wondering how you answer that.
I concede, if that's the word, that the book does not examine as thoroughly the broader social, economic, political forces that drive a nation, that drive a nation policy. This is one of sort of the debates within the profession. But I also argue that individuals do matter, that they make choices, and those choices are not foreordained, that they do have consequences. And by looking at these different choices, although perhaps economic dynamics as well as race, as well as gender and other components of culture don't emerge as prominently as they might do a book that is written about economic forces or social forces, that they are present, and that what by also focusing on individuals, I'm able to demonstrate that the growth of American empire was not as linear as it's often portrayed, but actually represented this sort of crazy quilt pattern, to some extent, a function of individual choices.
One of the things that you do so well in this book is demonstrate that while it's not maybe a straight line, the U.S. empire, that it goes all the way back, and you can just connect some dots there. And I remember during the opposition to Bush's Iraq war, people saying, this has never happened before. This is the first time the United States has acted like this. And you have this great line in the book. You say, those who criticize America's current empire builders for violating U.S. history have it wrong.
Well, yeah, I think that most Americans, and including Americans who are in policymaking position, are not particularly well-informed about American history, at least to the extent that I, as a historian, would like them to be informed. And consequently, to argue that what happened was sort of unprecedented, I thought really was a violation of history. There were, as in any event, certain sort of unique aspects to it. But, you know, I could argue even in terms of some of those arguments that there were parallels with Cuba in the 1890s and almost everything you can parse right. out different
Sometimes Bush sounded just like McKinley. I mean,
there were some, except that actually McKinley did anguish. You know, Bush was the decider and prided himself on sort of making that decision. It was closer to Truman and what he said afterward in terms of dropping the bomb that he never had a regret. And Bush's memoir makes that point very clearly, that if he had it to do all over again, he would not. The parallels with with McKinley. And here again, I think this is something that runs through my book, is McKinley basically argues not so much in taking in going to war, but in the decision to keep control of the Philippines, that he basically prayed to God and God told him this is what he should do. That resonates in a lot of the rhetoric, at least, of George W. Bush.
Yeah, that was one of the parallels that was ringing in my ears. Let's talk a little bit about Obama. Toward the end of the book, the very end, you are a little more optimistic than I am, or maybe you're less optimistic today than when you wrote it. And you said that Americans may finally have lost their appetite for expansion and empire. I kind of think that appetite is almost insatiable, and that the memory of the folly fades and the pounding of the heart at the national anthem and other patriotic devices is eternal.
You might be right. There's an interesting anecdote is that I initially did not write that last chapter. I ended the book with Wolfowitz and the World Bank and his sort of riding off to the American Enterprise Institute. My editor and actually others said that you cannot end the book that way. So somewhat under duress, I wrote this last chapter. When I wrote it, it was right after the election. I certainly did read very carefully all the speeches and everything else associated with Obama. I was also very aware of America's attitude or reaction to Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. And I argue in the book that they became, in many ways, the symbols of Iraq more than Saddam Hussein or even the execution of Saddam Hussein. And because Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, but also warrantless wiretapping had become so associated with that war, and these were such infringements upon our notion of civil liberties in so many different ways, I did argue that this may in fact be a watershed of sorts, that the Americans were finally forced to address this contradiction that I write about all over. Of course, it doesn't seem that it's turned out that way. And certainly the political system in America does not lend itself to those sort of shifts, certainly not overnight. Guantanamo is still alive and well. Issues such as FISA and other things are no longer in the headlines. Obama did, of course, agree to the surge in Afghanistan. So if you or anyone else criticizes me for being somewhat Pollyannish or overly optimistic, at this point it's hard for me to come back with a very strong rebuttal.
And I think the short answer is empire lives. And that's really the message of your book anyway. Just runs right through. And unfortunately, we're out of time. But Professor Immonen, I really want to thank you for being my guest and for this great book, Empire for Liberty.
Oh, it was my very great pleasure. Thanks so much.
I'll be back next week with Progressive Radio.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.